Welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps news, trends, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's January 31st, 2024, and I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. And if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. Answer a few quick questions and you'll get to book a meeting with me directly and we'll see if we can help move the needle for you. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. If you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I have one ask. If you find any portion of today's Office Hours valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. You'll find a link to the recent recording there, or send us a testimonial about the value you're getting in Slack. Just go to slack.cloudposse.com. Remember, we're not just simply creating content here. We are doing our best to build a community, and we can't do that without your help. So let's see what is on the docket for today. Lots of announcements, exciting things happening. One is if you are a Spacelift user and a Kubernetes user, you might be really excited to know that they finally have official an official. Whoa, what's going on with my browser here? There we go. An official operator for Kubernetes. Now, previously, Spacelift had Kubernetes support, but it was really just a Helm chart that deployed a deployment with N replicas that ran the Spacelift agent. Now they have a first-class operator that I believe supports auto-scaling, up to whatever your contract permits. So that should be a lot more efficient to run your Spacelift agents. This is also beneficial because now whatever you've set up for your Kubernetes observability should extend nicely to how you manage your Spacelift runners. There's also a related post, a technical overview of the implementation, and we'll share all these links in the Slack channel after the call. Next, this is a call for help from me, Cloud Posse. We're using Terraform Docs for something. We really want to release a feature, but we can't release the feature because Terraform Docs crashes. If you have null output values, it just doesn't work. Seg fault. So we submitted a pull request for this, but we haven't gotten any official approval, and there's just been radio silence. So really hoping if somebody knows somebody at Terraform Docs, if we can get this prioritized. So I'll post that in the Zoom chat right now. All right. Next announcement. Yes, near and dear to my heart. As you all know, we've been investing a lot lately in Atmos, trying to improve the developer experience, making it a little bit friendlier on the eye, easier for newcomers to the project to get started. And one of the ways we're doing that is by introducing console-based interactive menus, text-based UI. We're using Charm Bracelet, makes it really slick, and we have just now added some branding, so it's very clear to see what tool you're using. It's called Atmos, and I think it's kind of cool. The logo's always changing every time you look at it. The colors morph a little bit just because Atmos can be anything. All right, so here you have it. You've seen these other interactive menus we released previous weeks. The new thing for this week is the interactive, or I mean, is the branding around Atmos. We also added interactive workflows. I forget if I, yes. So we announced that we had the interactive workflows in Atmos a week or two ago. What we've added now to it is the ability for you to navigate between the individual steps of that workflow and run those manually. Again, just making these are things you could always do in Atmos on the command line. This is just making it easier so you don't need to know all the command line foo to get that done. More good things to come. I think next week we'll have another announcement on one of the next things we're trying to tackle from the UI perspective. Oh, here's what I was talking about. You see execute from step. You can use the menu to navigate to which step you want to start from and run if you're using a workflow there. Also, we made the help screen a little bit easier to parse by colorizing the help. This is an old help here, though, it looks like. So I don't know what that is about. Oh, that's the Terraform help. Yeah, of course, Terraform help is uncolored. And you see how bad that looks? That's why you need color in help. All right, any questions on that before we move on? All right. So a lot of users are using TFEnv. It's a pattern that's been around for a long time, going back to like days of Ruby, right? RBEnv and so forth. TEnv is now a successor to that, part of a organization here called Tofu Utils. So I guess they've taken a lot of the tools that like for pre-commit and TFEnv and made them Tofu compatible. I'm not sure who the organization is behind this though, so not an endorsement yet. Here is a new project, also an open source. Let me just close some tabs here. Also an open source project for generating better graphs of Terraform resources and dependencies. Now, anyone who's used Terraform for some time realizes there is a Terraform graph command, and it seems like, ah, oh, perfect. That's awesome. Exactly what I needed. Now I can just pipe that into dot and generate a graph, except for that graph is unusable because there are just too many edges in the graph. And trying to make it useful requires some heuristics, if you will, to reduce the amount of information in that graph. So this is a project attempting to do that. There's another one, I forget what it was called, that we've brought up on office hours. This one was a new one for me to make it easier to explore the graph of dependencies between resources in a Terraform module. Previously, we've tried to do similar things with Mermaid. I know we've announced other projects. We've found something that
There are
generates.
a bunch of them and a bunch of paid services that do this and a bunch of paid AI services that allegedly do this. They're all shit.
Exactly. So until I get to actually try it on my own project, this is not an endorsement. Your mileage may vary. And
I
to
can 100% tell you it will not work, and it's not. Ooh, it will not work because blood is mean. It will not work because people that actually research how to properly do diagrams do that with people that are good at diagrams. Those people are called design experts or human-computer interaction experts. Like, they are actually experts, not some Go developer. And those people will tell you why this is an absolutely dumb idea, and that's not how diagrams work. If you have an auto-generated diagram, not in 100% of the cases, but in 90% of the cases, it's shit. That is not the point of a diagram. That is not how you should be using diagram. This is useless cognitive load. And it's why all the projects that attempt to do this fail, because they reach the same limitations, because developers don't talk with experts. Like, I don't know, graphics people, human computer interaction experts, and other dedicated people that spend their lives researching this. They just, ooh, I'm gonna take the JSON and make it pretty, although I don't know what pretty means. So don't do this, please.
Lad's a little rough around the edges, but I have more or less come to Same conclusion. You want to show different things in a diagram. You also sometimes make some artistic, what's it? You take some artistic freedoms sometimes in diagrams where they might not be 100% accurate, but they better convey the concept of what you're trying to do by reducing information. Also, you want to show different like cross sections of an architecture because there will be too much information if you just look at it from this one perspective. So I agree with what you said there, Vlad.
So I was
Okay.
once asked to explain a Terraform plan that nobody knew how it worked, and I was brand new to the project. I just started. So I started by using a Terraform doc, and then I started eliminating a lot of the things that I think didn't matter manually. I spent a few days doing it and I abandoned it because it was just too big of a plan.
So yeah, and this is a classic problem about creating too large monolithic modules or root modules, and it's great because Terraform can just figure it out, but it really sucks in practice because the graph is just too large for anyone to understand what's going on. It becomes brittle, blast radius is big, and so forth. So yeah.
Maybe that's because a diagram or graph has to focus on a particular aspect of the architecture, and when you would auto-generate it, it will, unless you have something to parse and grab that aspect, you end up with a something that really doesn't represent
Yep.
anything, just
Yeah.
a bunch of things. I've just had the problem during the training. I just ended. I wanted to draw an architecture diagram and started to put everything in it. And a couple of days in, it just lost any things. And I believe the auto generation suffers the same issue.
Yeah. So I guess this is where, in a perfect world, one of those AI generated ones that Vlad brings up would be great, but I've never
No,
seen
that's
one.
the reason I'm so cranky about it. AI only makes it even worse.
Really?
Like, I thought this idea finally died down because people learned the lessons so many times that like everybody was able to easily find out, dude, this is why this will fail. But now you have AI and AI is magically gonna fix it. No, it's not gonna fix it. No. This is gonna be so condescending. I apologize in advance. Any senior plus engineer, so staff, principal, whatever, at some point. Alex, you're unmuted. Do you want to jump in or was that accidental?
Oops,
Okay.
I
Sorry. I assume that was accidental since he muted. What was I saying? Yeah, this is going to be very condescending, but any staff plus engineer, any senior plus engineer, so staff principal, whatever, at some point gives up on Lucidchart and all the tooling and goes to Visio if they're on Windows or OmniGraffle if they're on Mac. And starts paying actual designers and expert for building diagrams because they realize that they're in meetings where they need to decide on architecture and they have to present based on a diagram that is easily understandable, that people can look at for 5 seconds and immediately get what's happening there because the diagram is perfectly built for how our brains process information and la-di-da-di-da. And they discover this area and it's a very well-researched area. It's complete, we know about it. It's not automatable.
One thing
Has
I'll
anyone
throw in there,
has
one
any
thing
of
I'll
you
add.
walked into a situation where they want you to take them to Amazon, to AWS, but nobody in the company knows how the servers are built?
Yeah, they got bigger problems.
Because I had this about 15 years ago. I walked into a job where they wanted me to migrate them into AWS, and nobody at the company knew how to build a server.
Yeah. So crawl, walk, run, right? So maybe in those situations, an assessment is the first step, and then some initial modernization efforts before going full on into
Well, for me,
some.
step one was reverse engineering an existing server.
One thing I want to add about those graphs, you've got to really understand that when you take the time to develop a diagram, it is going to be a representation of the intent of the designers. When you have anything come over and automatically give you a representation of what's actually there, that can be very far from the intent of a design, as we
That's a
know.
good distinction. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yes.
so that's something to keep in mind when you look at anything like this. You're not going to be able to embed your intent in this automatically generated graph.
Yeah, and I would add that I think a lot of times this all comes about because folks are trying to understand undocumented code, and lots of lava flow, sort of organized. Oh, we need to fix this, fix that, and things get gobbledygook. Honestly is the kind of thing that when I look at a well-documented module or well-organized code, I don't really see the point in needing a diagram. The code just tells me what I need to do. So it's also sounds a little bit more like a panacea or a band-aid.
All right. And in a similar, another po possibly ill-fated project trying to do the same thing, generating these large diagrams. So this was me going down a rabbit hole on a Reddit thread and discovering some new projects I hadn't seen before. So that's where that comes from. All right, next announcement would be this was really interesting to me. I was researching what more kind of UI elements could be leveraged inside of Markdown on GitHub, and came across this because this is something annoying when you're doing plain Markdown and you have images, and now that half the developers are on in dark mode 24/7 and the other are system or light. Your markdown doesn't render the same way, especially if you have dark images. So there is actually a native way supported in GitHub to know which images should be shown when you're in a dark versus light color scheme. So I think we're going to go through and see what we can do to improve our readmes that we generate at Cloud Posse to take advantage of that.
Pro tip, you do want to have two completely separate images for light and dark. Like, don't use the same
Yeah.
image and just invert the colors or something like that. They're not gonna be helpful. If you're like, either just have an image with a light background because most people default to light, or have two proper images that are optimized for their own color scheme.
That's a tough one because you need a transparent background so that it melds with both of them, but then the foreground colors should be different for light and dark.
That's why I said two separate images.
Yeah. Or was it? Yeah, we have this image. We have this problem, for example, for a long time. Like this image looks perfectly fine on in light mode, but Terraform disappears when you're in dark mode. So this needs to be a different image.
And there are tricks like having a white outline for the black text
Yeah,
and something like that, but they
but
end
then it
up
just looks
looking
ugly
not
when you're in
ideal.
black mode or dark mode. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a way of defining the foreground colors to be like the opposite in light and dark. If it's a black
Yeah,
background, put
the
the foreground color on white.
invert filter for SVGs. It works, but the results, unless you're only working with black and white, are typically ugly. Colors
Yeah.
are hard. Again, design is hard.
Next one was an update on OpenTofu. So their sandbox application was filed a couple weeks ago, so you can follow that progress. Some interesting comments here. One thing that I didn't know in the CNCF is that the recommendations, all projects are, all new contributions to CNCF projects should be actually under Apache 2. So the project is currently licensed MPL. I don't know if exceptions are made or if you would just add a new license or something from a certain commit. And on a related note, there's been discussion on, you know, remember, if you'll recall a few months ago, Atlantis applied for the CNCF sandbox going back to September here. Pepe is also a SweetOps community member here. So they met with the OpenTofu folks and decided that the projects would not be joined and be separate. The underlying sentiment was that, well, Atlantis isn't designed to only support tofu. It is a more generic runner. You can actually run Helm and Helmfile and other commands under Atlantis. It doesn't have to be Terraform. Obviously, Terraform is what it was originally written for. And as such, because it will continue to support BSL-licensed HashiCorp tofu and then OpenTofu, which is the original MPL license, that it wouldn't make sense to move the Atlantis project. And I think that makes sense. Other than that, I don't have any other insights on what's going on there. Do we have Pepe on the call here? Let's see. No, he's not here. All right. Here is another service. There's a few of these out there. Managed service offerings for GitHub action runners that are less expensive than the Microsoft or you know, GitHub managed runners. This is also the implementation of this is also open source. It's AGPL licensed, however, but this is if you wanted to implement their solution for GitHub runners. The pricing is apparently 1/10 the cost of GitHub. Where was it? Here you can see. And faster. So you can see their builds are significantly faster than the corresponding runners on GitHub and less expensive, meaning the savings are actually potentially greater than that too. Obviously, you can still self-host these runners however you currently do your infrastructure. And it has ARM support. Thought this was a interesting story. We've heard of these. The previous windfall was for .io in the Indian Ocean. Now with the AI boom, .ai is a windfall for Anguilla, which is a small, tiny Caribbean island. Just a word of caution. I don't know who's managing their registrar and root servers, the root DNS servers, because there's a famous .io domain TLD hack, and this has like happened multiple times. So a researcher was able to find a major vulnerability in the .io domain. And that was only one of these situations. Also, the uptime of some of these TLDs is not stellar. So take that into account when you pick a cool looking .ai domain. I think if you do AI domain, it should just be a redirect to your like .com or something.
That's exactly why I really advise companies not to have a ccTLD posture for multi-regionality, because some of these regions have their, you know, their TLD DNS servers like in the back of a closet in a gas station. You don't know.
Yeah. And they're just more vulnerable to DOS attacks at the root server level. So here was an interesting hack, if you will. I mean, just the fact that you have null resources that can exec anything, you know, well, let's just face it, there are a lot of potential vulnerabilities with Terraform code that we kind of just look the other way on. Here was one vector where, well, using ANSI escape sequences, you can actually hide what you're doing by positioning the cursor on the screen and writing over something that happened. So a carefully crafted TTY output could be overridden. Of course, if you have colors disabled, then those things, or a terminal that doesn't support it, that won't happen. So he shows like an ANSI escape sequence here that masks something. That something was just exfiltrated from here. And last announcement was Kubernetes related. So everyone recalls Lens. Lens was a great like VS Code for Kubernetes type of desktop client. It went closed source, then commercial, then open source, and I don't know what the current status is of Lens. Seabird is a new project to kind of reproduce some of that. It's in its early stages, and I'm sure it doesn't have nearly the feature set of Lens, but depends on what you need. So check it out, Seabird. That's all the announcements I had. Let's see here in the Zoom chat. I did not take a look actually yet. Let's see here. Oh, Alex was sharing a similar link on light and dark images for GitHub Markdown. So this is the way that has been deprecated. Personally, I kind of like that way more. I mean, for Markdown, but that they've discontinued that, and they're going to be they only want you to use this method, yeah, picture element.
Eric, for the record, we're seeing the Google Sheets thing.
Oh, crap! When I clicked on the link in the thing, it opened up in my other browser. I've been trying out the Arc browser since people on my team have been saying nice things about it. And that's where I opened. Yeah. So here. So yeah. So be advised, if you see references to doing it this way, that was the original way, but it's been deprecated, as it talks about here. And yeah, this is the current best way to do it. Cool.
I just shared one link, Eric. It's just a LinkedIn post for now, but we'll be posting a blog post. But we did an upgrade of Terraform to OpenTofu for
Oh,
one of
cool.
our, larger client code bases, and went very, very well. Like I did it personally. It was primarily, I'm sure. You Andre approved a ton of my PRs last week, but or maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, but the main things I had to do were related to Atmos and automation with Spacelift. Making actual changes to the code to support Tofu was absolutely nothing. So yeah, pretty exciting. I'll be putting a blog post together on that, and we'll have that in the coming like month or so. But this is the teaser
Very cool.
to share that, hey, it works. It's really it feels
Yeah.
good.
That's awesome. What was the impetus to switch?
We were on Spacelift and we wanted to be able to use testing.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and really the big thing there is I was pairing with one of the junior engineers that we have as a client, and he's getting interested in Terraform, and he was like, so how can we test this? And I was like, well, it's funny you say that, we can't. But yeah, I think it's a this gives us that capability, and it's something that we want to start writing into some of our root modules, writing into I love I'm excited to see it when it when we start upgrading Terraform versions for the Cloud Posse modules, so that we can write tests there as well, because I feel like that's where those tests are really gonna hit the ground running.
No, that's
But
really
yeah.
interesting. Yeah. Supporting tests there. I'm not sure if you're aware, Matt. One of the things we're working on similarly or separately is Terra test helpers. So we're extending our Terra test helpers with support for stack configs or Atmos. Now, I know this is not what you were talking about in sense of that level of testing. What I like about this implementation is your fixtures can just be Atmos configurations to bring up a full environment, and then you can test and reproduce that. So this is testing and reproducing at the root module level, which is something that even the native Terraform testing isn't, addressing.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Are you going to use this in Terraform AWS components?
Yes and no. So the longer term plan there is we're going just speaking, openly, is that one of the challenges when you're operating in a mono repo that is used by multiple organizations, not just your own, is you need to support multiple releases or generations of the services there, depending on, where people are in their upgrade path. And yet you still, as a company, don't want to be hindered from moving forward. So how do you solve all of that? And the conclusion we ended up with is, well, you don't solve it in a monorepo, not practically.
Yeah.
If
I
we
remember
want
having
to.
this conversation, it was probably 1.5, 2 years ago, that like, yeah, it'd be great if Terraform AWS components was broken up, but it'd be a beast of an effort. So you folks are gonna take that
So
project on.
yeah, we've really had a lot of debates on this and tried on different decisions for a little while before reversing course on it. Like one of the things I was a proponent of was well, let's just have different literal directories within the components for different versions. But the team was really concerned about just the amount of explicit code duplication and then the tools that don't exist for helping to manage that. Versus if you use Git the way Git is supposed to be used, then it'll work for you. The other big problem with a monorepo strategy is if these things independently, their life cycles are different, have different versions, is how do you version those? GitHub releases are really only for single service repositories. For the most part, or things that logically make sense to version together. So we had explored tagging strategies to get around that or whatnot, but it's just like we're leaving so much uncertainty and giving up so much. So where we'll be moving towards is a V2 version of our components under
Whoa.
a
Okay.
separate Cloud Posse organization. And we will be building these from the ground up, leveraging all of our existing components, but making them more friendly to brownfield environments, B, supporting our release branch strategy so that we can continue to backport fixes to older releases, although we will, as a company, predominantly focus on the latest major release. But this will allow us to continue making breaking changes to our reference architecture. While maintaining stability for companies at different, levels of maturity for our modules.
Makes a lot of sense. The org split is purely because you didn't want this to dirty up the existing 500 repos you probably have, or yeah.
Yeah, discoverability is a real big challenge on GitHub. And we went back and forth on this, but I think this is really interesting for others to hear or learn about kind of our thought process on why we went down this route. So I'll talk about that for a moment. So we have this organization with hundreds of repositories. A lot of them are most of them are Terraform modules and so forth. It's the overwhelming coming here, knowing what to look for. GitHub is making improvements to repositories. They have this filtering capabilities here. But what's really annoying is they've just redesigned this, and they've added the ability to create custom searches and filtering, but we can't modify this sidebar at all. So how will you, as a newcomer to our community, know, oh, I should filter by type Terraform and provider AWS and do all these things, even though it's there, unless we provided a directory structure for them in some way. But there are other
I get your
reasons.
problem.
But there are other reasons to do this, though. And those didn't become as obvious to me until after we did it. So the inspiration for this is if you look at a lot of larger companies doing open source like AWS, and they have the AWS organization. Let's see here if this shows that it's part of the enterprise. It doesn't, which is weird to me. But so then they have AWS, they have AWS IA, and they have AWS like
AWS Labs for the experimental
labs,
stuff
right? They have an or something like that.
without the dash.
Oh, AWS labs without the dash, and they have
They
one
break their
for
own
the
convention.
Kubernetes controller and all of these things. And I guess that's one way to segment your projects. I think it depends a little bit more about the internals of AWS and how they organize those to give autonomy. But if you think about Cloud Posse, one of the things that's really nice about us doing it is you have proper segmentation of repositories almost as though you do for infrastructure, a production account, a dev account, a staging account. Now that's for software, promotion, but it ensures that if one of those orgs or accounts is compromised, the others don't fall with it. So imagine when you have, 1,000 repositories in different languages and different frameworks with GitHub Actions and runners and open source contributors and Cloudpot. How the attack surface is very large. So by splitting our ecosystem of GitHub Actions and Terraform modules and components and some and other things are planned are examples, it improves the discoverability. It allows us to give more people access that need it and less people who don't need it. And I can give up, like for our examples, that's fine. I can give a few more people administrative access there to operate unencumbered there. But for like the very sensitive nature of our Terraform ecosystem, we want to be very careful about who has that level of access. We keep that small. And I
That
like
makes a
that.
ton of sense. And are you planning on that further breaking out like all your GitHub Actions in one org? And then follow on question, is this possible and not costing you a buttload of money because you now are on enterprise?
Yeah, so there's somebody on the call who kind of caused all of this, and it's been cut here. And I was very anti like paying the $20 a month per seat, on principle because we were paying $4 a seat, so that's a 5x
Yeah,
increase
it's
to go to
massive.
GitHub. And on principle, yeah, I feel violated. But Venkat brought up the argument, and I think Venkat's company is at a similar stage in size, possibly a little smaller, but but he said, this is probably the most important piece of software we have to run our business, and $20 a seat is actually a very low cost when you compare it to a lot of other products. So,
I hear that. It's legitimate.
Just to add on to that, we're leveraging like the Terraform provider for GitHub, and it just makes a lot of everything that you've mentioned, Eric, a lot more manageable. Just doing IAC on the repositories that are going to be storing your IAC. It seems a bit nested, but as you mentioned, like the stuff around like the groups, the permissions, all of that, we can just manage all of that in IAC, and it's been super helpful for us.
You bring up another point, or you remind me of another point, though. So rule sets are pretty awesome, and the rule sets. Well, you can still do this in a mono org, if you will. Rule sets are very powerful. Let's see here. Is this the one I want to look at? Yeah. So you can target by patterns and properties. So you can do this in a mono org just as well. But one of the reasons why I think it's better in the poly org model is when you have required workflows and you pull them like from your like a .GitHub repo, you can more you can reduce the number of workflows you have in that repo. Now it does support you pull you having required workflows in any number of repositories as the source, so it kind of invalidates my whole point. This is building on another design decision that we've made, which is to first dust off the special .GitHub repository. We talked about this in earlier office hours. This is where you put your security files, the support files, governance, and all those other things. But it's also a great place to put your centralized shared workflows. And if that organization is topically relevant or like to a class of problems you're solving, Terraform, GitHub Actions, now that centralized repository can also be the centralized configuration for things like, well, that was the other thing I didn't announce. Which is like our README generator. We moved the template out of our build harness now to the organizational level. So this allows us to have a custom README template per organization while we just keep the same README YAML markdown for the actual details of the repository. We're also moving to square badges because they look so much cleaner now. I think we can get past the rounded edges on the old candy icons.
Quick question for you, Eric. Given that your naming convention with the prefix of Cloud Posse, have you found a way to like squat on that so that way no one else can create Cloud Posse
Yes. Well, I mean, you can probably contact GitHub for a cease and desist, on trademark grounds if somebody does squat. It does open up the concern, though. Like if somebody registered AWS dash Terraform modules, well that one exists. But there's an example. AWS Terraform modules, guess what? Not owned by Terraform, or not owned by AWS, not official in any way, yet often referred to as official. But yeah, the same goes for like Cloud Posse. Please. Nobody squat on our
Of course
repository.
not. It's one thing that I've been trying to. We are using multiple orgs, but we only have one public org. But we're looking at a very similar strategy of rather than putting everything in this one big org, how do we split it up? And we're still in the process of like, what should the categories be? We are not a popular open source project, at least not yet. So we don't have to worry about downstream dependencies so much of other people using it. So it's easier for us to move things around. But as part of that, we want to rename everything, be a little more consistent. I think we use Terraform module in most cases, and we have a Terraform dash prefix that we use in other cases when it's all a module. So we're trying to figure out what the naming convention should be. But yeah.
So hard. Oh, and nothing. So we did some research into this. So we're going to be moving our GitHub Actions over to the GitHub Actions org. But Terraform, we're not going to be moving it just because it's going to be way too disruptive to the thousands and thousands of people who use all the modules. So they're going to stay in the Cloud Posse organization. Obviously, I had wanted to move those to their own dedicated organization, but I guess that won't be happening.
Were you able to republish your GitHub Actions with the new org, or is it like a whole new act?
You actually don't even need to republish them or anything. I guess GitHub just handles it behind the scenes
Oh, it's
automatically.
super cool.
And we realized that because if you look at what is it, the Chekhov action or something, that one bounced around, and yet thousands of companies depend on that one, and yet it still works regardless of which URL you were using.
Ah, perfect. Thanks for sharing.
There is another concern, though, if you also go about this route, is from a security perspective, I believe GitHub redirects only work until something else squats on that exact repo name pattern. So, for example, let's say we were using Cloud Posse dash modules because it seemed like a good idea at the time. And then we said, ah, oh, that was not well thought. We should use Cloud Posse Terraform dash modules. So we move everything over. And then the redirects work fine, probably for that, until somebody creates Cloud Posse modules org again, creates a repo with the same name again, and then that redirect stops happening.
So the answer is
So,
keep your old org name, even if
yes.
you have to build a new one.
Yeah.
Otherwise, somebody could supply chain attack you.
Yeah. Similar on another related note, I don't know if I announced it or not. We did create Cloud Posse archives. We just had a lot of repositories that, were from previous generations of things we had done. But I'm a pack rat, a digital pack rat, if you will. I hate deleting things. So we keep them, but we just moved everything out of the way here to this archives. So it's there. You can check it out. We're just not planning to invest anything more in it.
Cool.
Which is also the, sorry, go on.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, we have a script that we've made. It's in a public repo. I'll link you to it. It's a backup tool script where, so we have multiple orgs, a lot of them internal, very different use cases, but, and sometimes we delete stuff or we archive or like sometimes there's stuff that we actually just delete entirely. And we've just, in addition to archiving, we're also doing like these backups of where we do a git bare clone. So we pull down the whole repository. And we have a service account that we created for GitHub that has access to all of our orgs. And basically we do a one-time configuration every time we add a new org to our enterprise. And we just run a backup like once a day or twice a day that just pulls down all the repositories, does a bare clone, all the branches, all the commits, shoves it into S3, and then it BARE. I believe it's a bare clone. I have to double check the script, but we spent some single digit number of hours making it, and it's been working out pretty well. And it's basically like a full clone type of backup. So in case you have folks on your team or even yourself, if you're doing a rebase and you accidentally mess it up, ideally you could restore back to an older version. Alternatively, you have to depend on a PR or some other process to get back to the older commit. And in this case, I'm a big offender of rebasing at times and force pushes. So this helps protect me in case I were to screw that up. But yeah, I'm happy to share that with you. It's pretty easy to get configured. It's like a cron that we just scheduled on our Kubernetes cluster.
Yeah, no, check that out.
Did you already cut over to enterprise, by the way? Or is that, it
We
sounds like,
did. We pulled the
okay.
trigger on it. Yeah.
And did you run into that breakage issue around your
Yeah.
GitHub workflow?
Well, I'm not sure exactly that one, but we ran into those kind of issues, like default permissions for workflows,
Yep, that's the one. Yeah,
change to
that's
the
the one I was
more,
thinking.
yeah, exactly, change to the more restrictive one, which is good, except for we had too many repositories to update, so we had to undo that setting. I think there were a couple other things. I don't think I anticipated the level of effort of creating the new teams again and inviting the people to them and managing all of that across the organizations.
Okay, we'll get across the teams part. But I know that workflow thing, that's been as multiple times. We've done the conversion for a couple customers, and that's always super annoying. You have no warning around it; it just stops working. So,
Yeah, it just did. Yeah.
for anyone else considering it, there's something in your GitHub workflows may break as soon as you go enterprise.
But it was a good tip that you gave me, which was if you do sign up for enterprise, don't upgrade your current organization, create a net new organization. We had to do that regardless because we wanted to use the GitHub Enterprise trial. But the GitHub Enterprise trial can't be used if you have a GitHub organization with marketplace actions, kind of, a gotcha there. So we created a new org and then invited all the orgs into that one.
Yeah, and for extra context around that, when we had tried upgrading our current account to enterprise, it literally we waited like 3 or 4 days trying to figure out how do we actually use enterprise. Like, oh, there's all this stuff in the documentation, but we can't actually use it. And we
kind of like phone with a rep, and they're like, it's a 50-50 shot of it actually working. And I'm like, what?
Oh.
So we just went ahead and pulled the trigger on doing a new account while we waited for a rep. That never got fixed. We just don't spend enough money with GitHub. We aren't in the thousands per month yet. So
Yeah.
basically, obviously, lower priority for them. And just created a new account, migrated over, got a free trial out of it. So that was nice. And
Oh my God.
just
Like
worked.
dealing with GitHub Enterprise support, like on this, also as a smaller company, we had a 30-day trial, and average response time is 8 days. So you can imagine that, that's that's 3 to 4 email exchanges with them before you pull the trigger, 1 week in between every response, pulling teeth. So.
Also, when you're an enterprise, the support isn't necessarily the support is good, but there are, as you can imagine, enterprise add-ons for support packages. So it does cost like low digit it does cost some money. It'll cost you a couple grand, I think, per month on some annual terms. But I think if you need like a 30-minute SLA or whatever that might be, they've got options like that. But for the most part, even their free support, whatever you get. It they actually I usually get my questions answered. It's been pretty good.
All right, let's see here. What was somebody else brought up? K8 Studio. This was earlier in the call when we talked about the browser. This is that, I think this is a paid solution, right? Not open source. Yeah. Download, contact support, Git. What is this? K8. Oh, no. Well, yep. Got me. I think that's lame when there's a they hey check out our GitHub, get our project, and then oh no, it's a README saying, it's not open source.
They have almost 600 stars, though. That's pretty good. It's more than I
Yeah,
have.
that's all you need with a get a nice picture there and put Kubernetes in your name. Okay, I think that yeah. Soul searching. I think one of the problems we made was not calling Atmos, Terra Atmos or something. If we had Terra in there, it would have made all the difference. But okay. Was somebody trying to say something there?
I was just saying Terra or Hashi.
Yeah.
Hashi would have gotten you sued. I agree with you, though, Eric. if you had put Terra in front of it, people would have gotten it more. I feel like I run into people and tell them we use Atmos, and they're like, "Oh, what does that
Yeah.
do? I don't
Yeah.
get
Yeah.
it."
Working on that.
You guys are doing a good job. There's adoption coming. I've seen it pick up a bit.
Oh yeah. No, I'm very excited to see that.
I'm gonna show around that the terminal UI that you made is really awesome. I'm gonna make a post about that and brag about it to other people. So kudos to y'all on that. I said it before, but saying it again.
I would love that, Matt. That'd be really awesome. Cool things coming to vendoring as well. I want it to feel more like NPM install, modern vendoring experience for components. So. Oh, cool. Thanks for letting me know, Jeremy.
Maybe tofu is a better word, tofu Atmos.
Yeah.
And that makes me ask the question that it was on my mind while we were talking about GitHub a bunch. What are we gonna, I have this problem internally because we're like writing this. I'm thinking about writing. We're writing more blog posts on Terraform, and yet we're like going to be talking more about tofu. And it's like we now have to choose which word we go with, like the old one or the new one, and it's kind of
No.
painful. And then like new modules. Like let's say I just want to release a module that. When tofu gets a 2.0 and it's like maybe feature blocked where it's not backwards compatible,
Yeah.
do we, yeah, do we, are we naming things tofu AWS brand new service? Or, yeah, I don't know. It's going to be confusing. And I don't know if there's anybody who has, I'm sure there's somebody who's talking about that in GitHub issues in the OpenTofu repo, but I feel like that is going to be an interesting change that we're all going to have to deal with in some way or another.
That
It's just
feels like a
frustrating.
pretty good SEO opportunity for you for both of your companies, where calling it Terraform components, start with tofu components, be ranking number one on the Google searches for literally all the AWS or any other services that you're offering.
No, you're totally right. I mean, and in all honesty, I mean, that's how Cloud Posse got to where we are. We were very early in adopting modules, and they were relatively young when the concept was relatively young when we got started. Also, not very well appreciated the benefit of modules. Now that's taken as a foregone conclusion. I think the same opportunity exists with OpenTofu and calling the module something around that. But the bigger existential quandary that I have is the same one I deal with when we talk about Pulumi. So, on the one hand, I totally get why developers love Pulumi, and I would love to get on that bandwagon. But the underlying thing there is why you adopt Pulumi is so you can write infrastructure in the language you choose that you like to write in. Because that's what you understand. And yeah, Pulumi supports cross-language support, but that's not the reason you select Pulumi. You select Pulumi because, yeah, we do TypeScript, we're going to do TypeScript infrastructure code, or we do Go, so we're going to use Pulumi and Go. So if Cloud Posse were to write a whole bunch of useful modules, the equivalent of modules in Pulumi, what language do we pick? And if we pick, everyone says, oh, that's obvious, pick Python. Yeah, that's obvious because that's what you're using. And then the other one says, no, that's obvious, use TypeScript. And then, well, I think there's just diminishing returns. And that's what I've loved about Terraform is like there aren't really any alternatives. You don't have to support every variation. And that makes what we've done at Cloud Posse possible. It's like we don't try and support GitLab, and we don't at the same time we support GitHub Actions because they're two totally different systems. And if you try to optimize for both, you don't get the best of either. So what are we going to do with tofu now and open tofu? And I don't know what the answer is. We're going to continue calling things Terraform for the foreseeable future, but this is really just turning a blind eye to the inevitability of like when there's dynamic module sources and dynamic backend configurations, what's going to happen then?
Ditto everything you just said. Like I've always been that idea of like, hey, let's create a multi-language support for infrastructure as code. The idea, I could see why it would be really entertaining or interesting, but then you're bifurcating the community that I think was the biggest drawing factor to me, be like, oh, Terraform is awesome. Look at all this amazing open source. The other thing that bugs me about the hey, let's use different languages. And then they added like cross that you can like use a Python module inside your TypeScript Pulumi project, right? Can you imagine going and debugging that and what the nightmare that is? Like, that's not something that you would really want to do. And if you're signing up for that, is that, yeah, I don't know. It just
Provisioning
seems like a
the
mistake.
VPC called some stuff written in Go, some stuff in Python, some stuff in TypeScript, and the problem was deep down that chain. Like, I guess there's some inevitability as we move higher up the value chain that things like that will happen. I'm just not sure we're ready for it now. So I guess this is what Pulumi. Maybe Pulumi will win. So Pulumi will help you do tofu and Terraform. You pick what you want to do, and it'll be the cross
For SEO reasons, I feel like there might actually
transpiler.
be adding in the word tofu in addition to Terraform. It might create some confusion, but you might just rank high on both terms.
But yeah, we're giving it some thought. I have some ideas that, things we might do. It relates to other things that we have to do at Cloud Posse around our examples and GitHub Actions and but too soon to talk about. Well, we are a little bit over here. Want to be mindful of everyone's time. So thank you all for joining us for a wonderful office hour session. This concludes the Q&A portion. We're going to move into wrapping things up here. If you haven't yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, please check it out. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse and subscribe. We'll be posting a recording of today's session there. Great way to share it with your team and spread the love. If you are curious about what Cloud Posse can do for you at your organization, go to cloudposse.com/quiz. answer a few quick questions, and you'll book a session with me directly, and we can see if we can move the needle for you. We do syndicate our office hours as a podcast at podcast.cloudposse.com. So this recording will be available however you listen to podcasts. To register for these live office hour sessions and ask your own questions or participate in the debate, go to cloudposse.com/office hours. Send us your email and register. You'll get an invitation from our Google group with the private link to join our Zoom call. The newsletter goes out weekly. When I remember to hit send, go to newsletter.cloudposse.com to subscribe. Well, that's it in a nutshell. Thanks, everyone. Good times as always. Take care.